everybody across the land. Here's a special from Sequel Cast, though I don't know what it's gonna be about. Maybe Woody Allen, maybe Spike Lee, maybe Technicolor, maybe 3D, or maybe you just gotta wait and see. 'Cause you're gonna find out.
Welcome to Sequel Cast Special. Sequel Cast Special is a show that looks at topics usually sometimes relating to movie sequels. It's kind of topics at large. And this week we're looking at home video formats like Blu-ray, VHS, DVD, streaming, all sorts of fun and goodness right over there. And we'll also
it's
talk a bit about
all the fun of the movies in your own home.
Build a home video library with the Disney collection. Da, 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 da. Yeah.
Look, Captain, Laserdisc. Oh, it's not compatible with my system.
Yarg. So, I mean, there's a lot of things we'll talk about. We'll also touch about, like, bootleg videos, which is something I always associate with home video formats.
Yep.
So, check out our website, sequelcast.com, and check us out at facebook.com/sequelcast. I'm Matt, and that's Thrasher.
Hello.
And I'm thinking of home video formats. Growing up, did your family have a VCR or was it Betamax? What did you guys have?
Yeah, my father's always been, generally speaking, has been an early adopter of technologies, except the home computer for whatever reason. And so we had growing up, we had a Betamax for quite some time. Eventually, made the transition over to VHS in the 90s.
Yeah, we had a VCR, but the reason why we got it as a gift. My dad is very late with adopting new technology, but we didn't really have video.
Just fostering it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we didn't have videotapes at home that much, except for like Pinocchio or Sleeping Beauty or something like that, until we moved to the States. And then my dad was really shocked. You could just go to the store and buy a videotape for $20 of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid or something.
Hmm.
Not that I got more into the collecting part of it when I was in high school. So, hey, did you ever see a Betamax?
No, we had a Betamax.
Oh, you had a Betamax.
Yeah.
When did you switch to a videotape?
It was
VCR. I mean.
It would have been the late 80s, now that I think about it. I don't know a specific year. I do remember for about a year and a half, we actually used both machines. And I think the only reason we switched over to VHS was simply that you couldn't find Betamax anywhere anymore.
Hmm.
But we had so many things on Betamax, we continued to use it until the machine finally gave out. Which is a shame. There's lots of stuff that we had on Betamax that, as far as I know, you can't get today that I wish we still had.
That's really neat.
We had a Betamax tape just loaded with Gumby shorts, and I found those very hard to find. I would love to have that Betamax of Gumby shorts.
Now, on Betamax, it's similar to VHS in that it's a tape, but the video quality was actually higher.
Yes, and oddly enough, even as a kid, I could tell the difference between Betamax and VHS. So I guess I was a format nerd back then.
I'd love to see it side by side to see you know, what it looks like.
On an old-fashioned analog television.
Of course, yeah, no, plugging a VCR into a high-def TV is kind of kills the point right there. Yeah, you know, with DVD was the next real big... Well, I guess before DVD there's Laserdisc. I never had a Laserdisc player. I didn't know anyone that... Well, I had friends that had one, but I never got to see one in action.
I have never seen a Laserdisc player. I know they existed, but I don't know anyone who had one. I don't know anyone who had a Laserdisc.
Yeah, they were super duper expensive back then.
Yeah, I guess Laserdisc was a bit too early, and we expect, as technology advances, we expect things to generally get smaller. I mean, the cassette tape was smaller than the 8-track, and yet the Laserdisc, as I recall, were practically the size of records, of vinyl albums.
Yeah, and I think with the Laserdisc, no matter what, even though they had a few different formats, it's like some of the first generation DVDs where you had to flip the movie over halfway.
Well, I just to people who manufacture DVDs and who design DVDs and things like that, Stop making DVDs you have to flip over for any reason. I don't care if it's standard format on one side, widescreen on the other. Just put them both on one side. It's confusing.
You know, that does remind me, when I worked at a Blockbuster Video, it was when DVD players first came out. Mm-hmm. And so we had a small DVD section. Everyone would come in and they'd complain, oh, I'm missing part of the picture on the screen. There's black on the top and the bottom.
Oh, Lord.
Laserdisc, there's some Laserdisc stuff that was widescreen and a few videotapes, but really DVD is kind of forced widescreen into the mainstream, but you didn't have widescreen televisions at home for quite some time.
Which is it's as if these people have never seen something in anamorphic CinemaScope or any of those awesome broad formats. It looks so much better that way, and I really am disappointed with how prevalent pan and scan, pan and scan was so prevalent that even today there are still people who seem to think that that's how you're supposed to watch certain movies. Actually, and I remember one of the greatest coups of the VHS era when back in the 90s, when the new cycle of Godzilla films was finally being released in America, Godzilla vs. Biollante was accidentally released in widescreen. And the company, I believe it might have been HBO Home Video, whoever released it, was upset about that and actually tried to recall the tapes. But the Godzilla fans were thrilled because this is how we had always wanted to see a Godzilla film.
You know, the only videotapes I knew off the top of my head that were widescreen is the Woody Allen film Manhattan was widescreen, and that was on the assistance of Woody Allen. And I think the Blade Runner director's cut was widescreen. And every once in a while for a cult film, they might have a deluxe widescreen edition. But that certainly wasn't something I was familiar with until DVD came out. And when I worked at Blockbuster Video, the customers complained about it. And I'd have to say, if they wanted full screen at the time, the MGM DVDs, it's like you said, Thrasher, like you hate the DVD, you have to flip over. One side was the full frame, and then you flip it, and the other side is widescreen. But to tell, you'd have to read the really tiny print on the inside of the disc.
No, here's a question, Matt. If you went to a restaurant and you could choose between a steak or a steak with three big bites taken out of it, which would you want on your plate?
A full steak.
So why would you want less of a movie on your screen?
I think because most of the TVs around that time were had the square ratio. And if you don't have the image fill your whole TV, you feel like you're getting, the average person might feel like they're getting ripped off.
It's a big plate.
Even if it's not in the format the film was made in or intended to be seen. Although a lot of older films were filmed in that, what they called the Academy ratio or the 4x3,
Well, I guess with me, it's a particular sticking point because I've always loved cult films and hard to find films. And it's, I always feel, screwed over when I finally track down a film, but it's been interfered with in some way, whether it's been edited for content or it was taped off of cable in Europe, but part of it's missing because of a tape break. I don't like it when movies are meddled with and when I feel like I'm not getting the whole experience.
Yeah, it is one of those things that's strange. I mean, I guess before we go into other modern formats, back to videotape for a second. You mentioned you want to talk about bootlegs.
Actually, yeah, I could talk quite a bit about bootlegs.
What about them? The first time I ever saw bootlegs really was at comic conventions.
Yeah, it's the same for me. I guess what it comes down to is bootlegs are important. There are interesting films, experimental films, and wonderful films that I want to see or to be exposed to that just for whatever reason aren't for sale by and I guess, well, here, actually, I've got an example.
Okay.
This is the very first bootleg tape I ever got my hands on. It is, I believe the literal title is Mei's Super Burst Space. It was an anime. To explain to a modern audience, there was a time where if you wanted to see Japanese animation, tracking down a bootleg copy of a copy was the only way you were going to see it. And there were, in fact, people who just sort of made their own little cottage industries of getting videotapes from Japan, coming up with really basic subtitles, reproducing those however they could, and then, you know, selling them in these plastic cases at conventions. And there's just whole series which the only way you were ever going to see them is if you could track down a bootleg.
And that was a lot harder to do at the time, too, when VHS was the big format, doing your own subtitles and stuff. Now on a computer, you can do that. I mean, it still takes time, but it's a lot easier.
Well, yeah, it was a bit more technically involved. I mean, so the people doing this stuff were very, very dedicated. And on the one hand, you know, it's a shame that this stuff wasn't available sooner, but at the same time, I'm so glad there were people who were willing to make these bootlegs. And you know, I'm from a whole generation where most of the anime I saw growing up was from these bootlegs. There was a time period, late 80s, early 90s, where there just flat out was not Japanese animation of any sort on television, and certainly not that you would see in a movie theater. Then, of course, you also have cult films like A Chinese Ghost Story, which, to the best of my knowledge, I picked this up the year 2000. To the best of my knowledge, this had never been released in America, and if it had, it certainly wasn't available on DVD or any other modern format, which is a shame. This is sort of the definitive Soo Hark movie. It's got everything: romance, comedy, action, intense special effects, Asian mythology. It's an awesome supernatural action romance that has – it's often referred to as the Evil Dead of Asia, and I think it's pretty much earned that title. And then finally, bootlegs of things that would – and I think this has now been – this since then has been officially released, and thank goodness. I do want to pick it up on Blu-ray at some point. But and then finally, the other category, things that you would never, ever see. In this case, the sequel to the live-action Kekkoukamen, which Kekkoukamen is a very bizarre superhero. It's a superhero adventure story that's set at a boarding school where the teachers use corporal punishment and torture techniques to motivate students. And so Kekkoukamen is a superhero who only patrols this campus and rescues students from cruel professors. But her whole deal is she only wears a mask and a cape. She fights torture naked. And it's this bizarre superhero sex comedy. This barely qualifies as a movie. it was filmed very cheaply. I honestly think it was filmed on a camcorder. Just the quality of the images, even before being a copy of a copy, are very, very low. And yet it's also, because of the weirdness on screen, it is nonstop hilarious. I love that the art teacher, it's all Japanese except for the art teacher, who is Caucasian and named Chuck, and for some reason wears a Rastafarian hat and an Africa medallion. And who eventually turns into a cyborg with flamethrower feet. I don't believe this has ever been released in America officially, and I don't think it ever will. There was a later Kekkoukamen live action that was, but that was after the anime boom when this stuff became much more marketable. And that's the thing with the underground and bootleg movie trade. To the people who own the rights to these movies, I want to spend my money to own these movies. I want to have these movies. But if you're not selling it to me, then damn it, I'm going to go to someone who will. And you know, when they are officially released, I try to pick them up. But for whatever reason, there's all sorts of awesome movies out there that people just think aren't commercially viable or have a terrible reputation, like Hardware 13, which only... I think it's Hardware 13. Hardware, which only very recently had a DVD release in the United States that was uncut. Previously, it had only been available overseas in a heavily edited edition.
We talked about different cuts, and that's something that, you know, would sometimes you'd see first at a bootleg, and then they'd later get an officially released. I remember at a convention, a friend of mine got a copy of the bootleg of the like the director's cut of the direct-to-video film Batman Beyond: Return of the Joker.
Oh yeah, I actually first saw the don't let this get out, Matt. But the first time I saw that at the Savannah College of Art and Design, someone in the animation department got a screener from a contact in Warner Brothers Animation.
Huh.
And the whole thing was, and like the funny thing is, every 10 minutes, this like little thing would come across the bottom of the screen, not for public display.
Yeah, I mean, that's something where it has some scenes that are more violent than the initial version that was released, but later the uncut version was. I mean, there's a classic bootleg tape of bloopers from the original Star Trek series.
Yep, which actually, those were also later officially released with, I believe, commentary by Shatner and Nimoy.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
It was kind of like, well, it was part of a bigger tape. It was like half the tape was a recording of a lecture that Shatner and Nimoy gave about Star Trek, and then the other half were the bloopers and behind-the-scenes interviews. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. One thing that sticks out to me when I think of bootlegs on videotape was the Japanese live-action film Battle Royale.
Oh, yeah.
Which was not available in the United States to watch until, I think, like just this past year, and Hunger Games came out.
No, there was an American subtitle, and I think later dubbed version, that came out around the mid-2000s.
Hmm.
A friend of mine in college had a copy.
Oh, okay. But, yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting film with the violence and stuff. And then Hunger Games, which I guess the author of the book didn't know about Battle Royale, the movie, when she wrote the first book. But there's definitely similarities in the premise, I think, between the two, and it's sort of different.
But yeah, but there's similarities to Running Man and any
story
where people have to fight to the death. I'm not going to claim any kind of plagiarism.
No, I'm not either. It's just it's an interesting take on in some ways a similar scenario, but in other ways they're different too. So I just thought that coincidence was sort of interesting. We've talked a bit about, about bootleg videotapes and, you know, things that never even officially got released. Think about in the 80s, they would show things like Superman the movie on TV or Superman 3 on TV, and it'd be like 4 hours long because they'd put in every single deleted scene you could ever see.
Yeah.
And then later when they release it on DVD and Blu-ray and streaming and stuff, you might have these deleted scenes as an extra feature but not integrated within the movie. So where do those scenes of the film go?
Well, that's kind of the funny thing, because in the late 80s, early 90s, even though there were fewer cable stations, those cable stations were absolutely desperate for content to fill airtime, which is where a lot of these extended television cuts came from. But at the same time, as cable became more popular, a lot of networks became more concerned about how much they could get away with showing, which is why there was a lot of specifically cable TV versions of films made. One in particular, just because I like the way they went about it, was Return of the Living Dead. If you get Return of the Living Dead on DVD, it's the original theatrical cut. They specifically shot alternate scenes for the TV version to cut down some of the that had less violence, less language, and less nudity. But what's fascinating is that one of the characters it has a red jacket. On all the scenes from the TV version, he's not wearing the jacket, and written on his shirt is TV version.
Huh.
And just because of the humorous bend to the film, they intentionally did that. So
yeah,
you can know which cut of the movie you're watching based on whether you can see scenes with the TV version shirt on.
Yeah, I mean, you think of the different home video formats. There's stuff that came out, you know, in VHS that's not available on DVD, and there's stuff on DVD that's not on Blu-ray, and stuff that's on streaming that's not available on the, you know, the physical formats at all. I'm thinking of, there is a release they did of, it was on TV first, and then I think on videotape, where they did The Godfather 1 and 2, but they recut it so it's chronological. With deleted scenes in there, and that's never been redone in a disc-based format.
Cool.
And looking at our SequelCast Facebook page, listener Jordan Alleman said a format that he collects, which I've never even heard of, is a Capacitance Electronic Disc, CED, which was an analog video disc playback system that was out, released by RCA, that had a needle that played in a groove, sort of like a phonograph record or something.
Oh, I have heard of this, but I'd never actually seen one.
Yeah, me neither. And you want to
but
talk
I,
about...
I remember this format. I think I actually... I think I remember it when it was released, and I also remember this coming up in one of my film classes. We had a class where we talked about formats, format histories.
Yeah, I've never seen that in person. I remember hearing about it in high school with the, I don't know if anyone had one, that of my friends. And the other thing of the disc-based format is overseas for a while, the video disc format was popular, where it was, I think, before DVD or around the same time, but it was like lower quality. And I guess it was a pretty popular bootlegging format too. I remember walking into a store and they sold a video CD of the Rudels. Of all the things in that format, the Rudels.
Hey, all you need is lunch.
All you need is lunch, exactly. So what do you think about Blu-ray, which for a while had its own sort of VHS Betamax thing going on, where we had HD DVD came out first, yep, and then Blu-ray came out slightly afterwards, and Blu-ray ended up winning.
Well, yeah, it's to me, it's inexplicable how Blu-ray won, only because Sony is always itching to start a format war, and it hasn't won. And I don't think it had won any significant format war until Blu-ray, and it's just like and I have no idea how that happened, just because the format's so expensive and whatnot. Strangely enough, and I guess this sums it all up. My girlfriend and I went halvesies and got a PS3. When there was a store that was selling them for $100 off, although this was after one of the PS3 network's many scandals, so I think it was a face-saving measure. We got it in part to play some a handful of games we were interested in that weren't available on other systems, but also because it was the cheapest way for us to get a Blu-ray DVD player, or Blu-ray player, and as far as I know, it still is. We have yet to watch a Blu-ray on it.
Really?
Even though we picked up several Blu-rays when our local Blockbuster went out of business. That's it. We had it for like 4 or 5 months before we actually got any Blu-rays, and that was when the Blockbuster went out of business. And we haven't watched any of those DVDs or any of the Blu-rays.
So why is that? Is it just that so much stuff is streaming now, or?
I guess part of it's that. I guess the other part is I'm waiting to be let. Like, I'm waiting for the moment I put in a Blu-ray, I'm going to go, what? This is what won the format war? I guess.
Yeah, it's a format I like. I mean, it stayed more expensive for longer than I think DVD did.
Yeah, DVD. Yeah. It's liberating how cost effective those are.
Sure. And especially, you know, with a lot of video rental stores going out of business. Viewers, if you're watching this on YouTube, and you can do it at youtube.com/sequelcast, if you notice in the background I have this cube, and my cat Waffles is in the cube. So if you see a cat staring in the background out of a cube, that's my cat Waffles.
And if you see a Cthulhu staring in the background of mine, that's a Cthulhu.
And if you're listening to it, this will be a stupid segment.
uh, visual segment time.
Yeah, even though Blu-ray 1, like, I don't think it's something everyone has in their home like now DVD players have. And even though it's gotten cheaper, like, it's not... If someone has it, it might... I think Sony did a survey where they found out that PlayStation 3 owners didn't realize it could play Blu-ray movies.
Well, that's a whole other issue, but yeah, PlayStation doesn't even know whether their PlayStations can play PlayStation games.
You're referring to PlayStation 2?
Well, I'm referring to backwards, the sketchy backwards compatibility on the PlayStation 3.
That's a long and confusing history.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Which we're not getting into in this show, but it's an interesting point.
Fun anecdote. Back when I used to work at a store that sold video games, we had a guy come in and get a new Silent Hill game had come out, and he picked it up for PlayStation, and he picked it up to play for PlayStation 2. And as I'm getting ready to check him out, you know, we're just chatting, and he says, "Man, I can't wait to put this into my PS3 and start playing." And I'm like, "Oh, you have a PS3? Yeah. Well, actually, it's out for PS3. Oh, I don't want to pay that much for that disc. Besides, they look the same, right?" Well, actually, no, sir. You can't. Yeah. Putting a PlayStation 2 disc in a PlayStation 3 doesn't upgrade the graphics in any way. Well, then what the he just completely turns. Well, then what the hell's the point of having a PlayStation 3? And I just calmly and flatly told him to play PlayStation 3 games and Blu-rays. Yeah. And he just gives me the angriest how dare I be wrong look.
Huh.
And then walks out with his disc.
Well, I mean, I said I wouldn't get into it, but I mean, with the PlayStation 3, there's various versions of the system over the years, some of which can play PlayStation 2 stuff and some of which can't.
And some which can play PlayStation 1 stuff and some which can't. Some that can play all play
PlayStation
1. Pardon?
They can all play PlayStation 1 games.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to get out my copy of Tron Bond and test that.
Yep, that's something they never took out of the PlayStation 3. But, I mean, we're not... That's kind of related to what we're
wrong with Sony?
Supposed to be talking about with home video formats.
But Sony has a lot to do with home video formats.
They absolutely do. And, I mean, I think part of the reason the Blu-ray stuff didn't take off quite as much as they would have liked is the rise of streaming with things like Netflix, Watch Instantly. Well, I mean, first off, YouTube, and Hulu Plus, Hulu, I don't know. The Crackle is Sony's little streaming thing.
Yep.
There's so many different ones out there that offer very good video quality.
And also most of the networks stream a lot of their content as well.
Off the website, yeah. Sites. So what do you think about, like, what sort of streaming video stuff have you used, Thrasher?
I've used Netflix, I've used Crackle, I've used Hulu.
Yeah.
Something I have noticed, I only stream off of a network's own site out of desperation. Just generally speaking, I find them very difficult to use, very frustrating. I cannot stand the way they handle advertising on the official network sites. It's always I find it less, strangely enough, I find it less convenient going directly to the source than just using a third party streaming site.
Yeah, you know, at home, my wife and I used to have cable, and it just got so expensive. Now we just have the internet, and we get the Netflix, just the streaming, and the Hulu Plus, just the streaming. And we recently got an Apple TV device that lets us watch videos off if we buy like a season of a TV show or something, we can watch it on the TV. And that's nice, because, like, I don't know, a lot of the cable channel stuff isn't really streaming. I mean, Comedy Central stuff is... on a lot of the services, but not things like Food Network or Logo or HBO for that matter. Although the pricing on the Apple streaming video stuff really varies. Like, guess how much they charge for a current season of The Simpsons to get a season pass to download all the episodes? Take a guess.
Shall I guess again? $20.
$50.
$50 for one season.
Yeah, of The Simpsons No, you know, extra features. It's just HD copies of the current season.
The DVD box sets are cheaper than that. And I know,
like, that's crazy. But on the other hand, like, most other things are between, like, $10 and $30. I don't know. Like, HBO stuff tends to be more expensive. It really depends on what you're watching. But that price variance, I guess it just depends. Like, for instance, one thing that struck me as strange, maybe this has to do with the popularity of the characters. And I'll stop talking about Apple stuff you can get on iTunes video in a minute, but I just find it interesting, the price disparity. So, you know, like, Bruce Timm produced the DC animated stuff in the 90s?
Yes.
Right. So the Superman animated series from the 90s cost $15 for a whole season. And that's to own digitally, not rent or whatever. The Batman animated series, guess how much that one is?
More.
35.
Yeah, it's strangely enough the more popular character, which is a shame. I love the DC animated Superman. I mean, I love both series, but Superman is my favorite.
But, like, as great as all the Netflix and Apple and all that stuff is, I do spend a lot of time watching videos on YouTube, which, I mean, that's turned into a whole thing by itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I don't know what it is, but it's something where you don't need a great internet connection to watch YouTube.
But it's generally convenient, and it's great if you have something short you want to get out there.
Right. That's a good point. And you're talking about video formats, SQLcast listener Ben Kane was saying he really likes Blu-ray because of the high definition, and he's from Australia, and he says the internet speeds aren't fast enough there to cope with HD streaming. But they're getting to that point.
You know what? Speaking of Australia, and I do not know... I do not know if this is still the case, but the late 90s, the rise of DVD, the late 90s, the early 2000s, Australia was getting everything on DVD 6 months to a year before the United States.
Before?
Yeah, and I don't know why, but they got the Futurama DVDs way ahead of us. They got the Buffy the Vampire Slayer DVDs way ahead of us, and that actually was a real sticking point. My cousin Sarah Faber, hey, Sarah. She's a huge Buffy the Vampire Slayer fan. And, you know, the Buffy the Vampire Slayer message boards, that was a real sticking point. It was Australian users which were bragging about how they had the complete season box sets. But it actually, that also brings up something. Regions on DVDs. I fucking hate regions on DVDs.
Yeah, you also have that with Blu-ray. Was that? And what we mean by regions is depending on where in the world you live in, just because you have a disc of something doesn't mean it'll play on a player in another part of the world unless it's an all-region player, which you usually have to unlock with some code in the remote or something.
But the data's the same. It's just this little bit of code designed to keep enthusiasts from... Like, it's such an attack... This is what I... The thing that infuriates me the most about capitalism is when corporations destroy a free market or make the market less free. And regions is a perfect example of that. And it's crazy how pervasive this is. I remember when I got my first computer, it had a program that would play DVDs. And when the first time I put a regioned DVD in it, I had to select my region. And I read through all the policy and stuff. Like, at first I thought, oh, well, this is great. I can just change my region if I ever get a DVD from another region. But then I read the fine print. You could only reset the program's region 5 times, and then it would lock, and you would never change it again, unless, of course, you wiped your computer and reinstalled everything.
Ugh.
Why the fuck is that there? That does not help anyone who buys or uses the DVD.
No, especially not for collectors. It makes them have to get an all-region DVD or Blu-ray player because, you know, even though the movie might be the same, it might be different special features in another country. I know, for example, the Canadian DVD of a David Cronenberg film, Is Extents, has a commentary by the director, but that's the U.S. version is bare bones. And, I mean, that's something I think we should touch on, too, is really it was first on Laserdisc, but it became more in the mainstream on DVD. where special features would be a big thing for home video.
I love special features. I'm addicted to audio commentaries.
Which commentaries in particular?
Well, I mean, really all commentaries. Any DVD I have with an audio commentary, I've listened to it. Although, yeah. In particular, I if I ever need something on in the background, it will be a Simpsons audio commentary. They're packed with information. They get hilarious people on them. They bring guest stars on for commentaries. They bring guest stars on for commentaries for episodes they don't appear in. you get so much out of them.
Well, and it's also remarkable with The Simpsons. They do audio commentaries on every single episode of every single season. And on so many other TV show DVDs or Blu-rays, and they release a box set, there might be a commentary or one or two episodes.
Yeah, that was the only thing I didn't like about The Critic on DVD. They only had commentary on about, was it 7 episodes or so?
Sure, but I mean, that's a lot more than, I mean, on most sets it might just be one or two, but yeah, no, it's not on all the episodes, and you kind of feel like you're missing something, especially, I think the commentaries where it's groups of people in a room tend to work best. If it's just a director or something by himself, you often get a lot of pauses, or on Jimmy Kimmel, they did a funny thing making fun of, Arnold Schwarzenegger did a commentary on the movie,
Jingle All the Way. Oh, yeah.
And had you seen the segment on Jimmy Kimmel?
No, I hadn't.
So on the commentary, they paid Arnold Schwarzenegger $70,000 to do the commentary. At the time on DVD, like on the first special edition of that film.
Yeah.
And all he does is like repeat what's happening on the screen. Like, oh, I punch this guy in the face and now I pick up the gun and I shoot them, but I'm actually the hologram, so he doesn't really shoot me.
Hey, the checks come either way.
Yeah, and they were making fun of that. They had him do, like, fake commentaries on top of clips from his movies, like Kindergarten Cop. And then when they got to the point of Predator on the on the fake commentary for the sketch, they decided Arnold Schwarzenegger say, like, when I did this scene, I was so hungry, I wanted to eat my mom's Schwarzenkuchen with a little bit of applesauce. And, like, he goes into all these, like, Austrian recipes with these complicated names that have nothing to do with the scene. But I thought that
One of the best audio commentaries you will ever hear is the Big Trouble in Little China with Kurt Russell and John Carpenter. Mm. That is the amazingly – it's a brilliant commentary. It's packed with information, and it's just like two friends talking about their favorite movie. It's like if we were doing an audio commentary face-to-face is what it would sound like, not like the audio commentaries we've actually done.
We do in sequel commentary, and like you're going to do them solo, and I'd love to join in on some of those too sometimes.
Oh, no problem. I'll keep you up to date.
Keep me in the loop of when you're doing it.
Yeah, and if you want to jump in, just let me know.
Sure, and you can check out Sequel Commentary, which is a podcast where we do audio commentaries for, you know, either movie sequels or cult films at sequelcast.com.
Well, what's a non-commentary special feature that you really like?
As much as I like commentaries, like a lot of times it's just a dude describing the screen. I like a really good meaty like feature length documentary. There's a great one on, it's on the Blu-ray and it's on the big massive like 10 disc set of Superman that came out when Superman Returns came out.
Oh yeah,
big metal tin, and they talk about the films leading up. I don't think they cover Superman Returns in the documentary, but the segments in particular when they talk about Superman 3 and 4 and everyone seems really embarrassed.
Well, yeah.
And in particular, one of my favorite DVD documentaries is on the Star Trek 5, The Final Frontier. And did I show you this one, Thrasher in College?
Yes, where it's like that extended reel of Shatner talking about mountain climbing.
Yeah, there's that, but there's like another one where it's a behind-the-scenes documentary about Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, and what a clusterfuck it was, and they didn't have like a real finished script on set.
Oh, and they showed the rock monsters?
Yeah, there's like the rock monsters deleted scene that was supposed to be part of the action climax, but then like, you know, in the script it called for 10 rock monsters, and then it came like they had to cut down on the budget. Oh, it's going to be one rock monster. Okay, we can film it from different angles, make it exciting. Oh, you know, the rock monster looks like shit, and it cost a quarter of $1 million or whatever. And they ended up not using it.
Yeah. But
it's something about a documentary about a terrible movie, I think, is just makes it really, really interesting. That's the kind of stuff I enjoy.
What about you?
What's a non-commentary feature you like?
I actually like I like isolated music tracks. I love it when there's something that has really powerful music. Hmm. I love watching it with just the music.
They don't do that so much anymore. They did that more when DVD started.
Not often, although actually two of the more interesting ones. One is the Doctor Who DVD for the serial Ghostlight. It has one of the absolute best scores of any classic Doctor Who episode.
So who is the Doctor Who in that one?
Sylvester McCoy, Doctor Seven.
Okay.
With Sophia Aldridge as Ace. Awesome companion. Probably my favorite, right next to us. She's neck and neck with Sarah Jane Smith. But anyway, and so you can watch the whole serial with the isolated music, and it's so creepy and atmospheric. The other one is there's an isolated music for Heavy Metal 2000, which it's neat because it turns the movie into a series of interlinked music videos, which is pretty awesome. But what's fascinating is that there's an ICP song on the soundtrack of that movie called This Is Our World, which plays when Julie Strain's character and Saint Germain are walking through this dingy space station. And inexplicably, the actions and the lip movements of every character syncs up with that song.
Huh.
Right down to there's a line where they go, "And one more thing!" And Saint Germain goes, "And one more thing!" It is fucking amazing.
Wow.
It has to be intentional. It can't just be an incident of the mind creating a synchronicity. It's just, it's too precise.
Well, speaking of Doctor Who, to go off a tangent for a minute here, I was in the bookstore and ran across a book. I don't know if you know about this. You might, because you know a lot more of the show than I do. The late
Is this Shada?
Author Douglas, what?
Shada?
Yeah, Shada. That they did a novelization of it?
I'm reading that right now, actually.
Oh, by Gareth Roberts. Okay. Cool. But the late science fiction author Douglas Adams, who wrote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, was he like a writer or producer?
He was a story editor, but he ended up writing three episodes of Doctor Who, only two that got made.
Yeah, and one of the episodes about Shada just got partially filmed.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a book that came out by Gareth Roberts that, you know, looks at the original scripts and kind of fills in the gaps. That's supposed to be pretty good.
It is. It is pretty damn near close to perfect. Not only does it capture the feel of the Tom Baker era of Doctor Who, but it also he really captures Douglas Adams' writing style. It really feels like Adams is over his shoulder telling him what he needs to put on the page.
And I guess they came out with a DVD set of it recently, where they
there was a VHS tape that contained like a lot of the surviving footage, and mm-hmm. I believe they were releasing, and it may be out now, a DVD for Shada that was going to have as much of the surviving material as they could get together, the script. There was some talk about they were trying to get I've actually the DWO WhoCast had a whole episode about this, about Shada and the Douglas Adams Doctor Who connection. And that podcast was recorded before it was actually released. I know at the time they were trying to get Tom Baker to read the script as a feature for the DVD. I have no idea if that came about.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it looks like there's a DVD version called the Legacy Collection.
Mm-hmm.
Of Doctor Who that came out in 2013. But, yeah, and they did some sort of, like, audio drama or something of it as a radio play.
Yes, Big Finish Productions took the original Douglas Adams script and did an audio drama starring Paul McGann as the Doctor and I believe Mary Tam as Leela, as opposed to Lala Ward, who would have been the Leela at the time. Not Leela, I'm sorry, Romana. And I've listened to that actually from beginning to end. It's very good, and again, it feels very much like a Douglas Adams radio play. And in part, they actually broadcasted it. This was on the BBC 7 website. Now it's BBC Radio 4 Extra. And they, when they broadcasted it between episodes, they had interviews with the people who made it. And that was one of the things they talked about. The guy who adapted it for radio said it was the easiest job he ever had because it was so dialogue heavy in that Douglas Adams style. It felt like a radio script to begin with.
Neat. So, I mean, with that tangent, we've talked about home video formats and bootlegs and stuff we've watched. Why don't we think about, out of all the different home video versions of stuff we've collected, what is a few that have really stood out? Whether in part of their special features or even just the way the packaging looked or...
Well, actually, something that stands out in terms, and this is in terms of sort of uneven quality, or all the anime tapes, all the anime VHS tapes I've acquired, both bootlegs and legitimate releases.
Why?
There's something very well, because like the anime bootlegs I have have, you know, there's a lot of quality issues, but they're clearly labors of love, and the people making them are trying to make them just as good as possible. But then, like with some of the official releases that I've picked up, you know, there are official releases of anime series where they didn't release the whole series, or where there are these inexplicable differences between the way certain scenes are subtitled or versus the way they're dubbed, or where you could sometimes even find content editing or these annoying trailers, just lengthy go nowhere trailers that are on the tape before the actual release, or like, you know, you're expected to, back in the day, you know, you're expected to spend $30-$40 for a tape that just has two episodes of a series on it.
Yeah.
Which was a model that they tried to carry over into DVDs, where they're expecting you to pay a huge price for a DVD that only has two or three episodes on it. Thankfully, that happens less and less now.
You know, they did that the first time they released the Star Trek, the original series, on DVD, doing two episodes.
You know, I believe I recall that.
Yeah, but that's when DVD really started. But right, I mean, I think that's gross, but... Yeah, when I think about, you're talking about the bootlegs, it reminded me of something in college, which was a horrifying bootleg experience.
Oh.
A friend of mine had a copy of the anime series Berserk.
Oh, I've heard of that.
On bootleg. I think you'd get a kick out of it. It's sort of a dark fan. Did you ever see it?
Oh, I've read some of the manga. I believe I read the first two volumes.
It's like a dark fantasy series, and the anime of it has less humor than the manga does. But the end of the series has such a dark ending that comes out of nowhere, and on this bootleg DVD, for some reason, as an extra episode, it just had a random compilation of clips from the show. But I thought that was a real episode of the show.
Huh.
So I was like, what the hell's happening here? There's this ending where all this terrible stuff is happening to the characters, and now it's a random clip show? That's the ending of the series?
Weird.
So that was a version of a bootleg that wasn't entirely done correctly, but it was sort of an amusing story. I really liked, I guess the DVD for like Fight Club and 7 really blew me away, because they had four separate audio commentaries on there from like the writers and the actors and the director and producer and all this stuff. I just, being able to look behind the scenes at a film at that level was really unusual at the time.
We don't, something that I, this is a weird thing. Steve Odekirk, who's a comedy, I think he's mostly a producer now, but he's also been a comedy writer and director. He released a series of direct to DVD shorts. They were all like parodies, but done with these like digital puppets created on people's thumbs.
Yeah.
And They did one called they did a Blair Witch Project parody called the Blair Thumb Project, and it has an audio commentary. It has two audio commentary tracks. It has the regular audio commentary track where it's him and like some of the voice actors and some of the technical people just talking about how they did, joking about how they made Blair Thumb. But then the other one is the insane audio commentary, where it's all the same people babbling incoherently for the entire length of the show. It's about a half hour.
Wow.
And it's weird because some of them start saying some phenomenally creepy things. And the absolute best part is about 10 minutes in, Steve Odekirk goes, okay, guys, let's all quiet down. I think we need to explain to the listeners what we're actually trying to do. And then they start rambling incoherently again. It's very amusing.
I remember. Oh, geez, what is this?
You remember Harry?
No, not Harry.
Uncle Vanya?
What was I going to say? Geez. Oh, I mean, one thing that I think is always fun to watch on video is trailers. There's something about a really good movie trailer that can be more entertaining than the movie itself. And yet there's other trailers that are so terrible, or it's such a weird combination, like you're wondering, what is this doing on this movie? Like, I rented the Blu-ray of, there's that musical that came out recently starring Tom Cruise called Rock of Ages. Mm-hmm. And as part of the trailer reel before the film started, they had a 2-minute infomercial about that you should plan your next summer vacation to Florida. It had nothing to do with the movie. And then before the movie loaded up, it showed the cheapest menu I've ever seen. It was just a still image of actors from the movie with the little menu on the side.
Well, you know, to this day, they still list interactive menu as a special feature on DVDs.
They do. Is there any like menus on DVDs you thought were cool?
Any what?
Menus. The design of the menus themselves.
Some of the coolest menus I've seen are also some of the most annoying. Like, any menu where all sorts of stuff like moves around or flies on the screen before you actually get anything you can interact with, I can't stand after the first time, because then it wastes my time if I want to watch that DVD. Any menu where you have to like do something before you actually get the menu to play the DVD is very frustrating after the first time. Some of the best menus actually are, interestingly enough, on the Simpsons DVDs. The last couple of seasons, the menus are animated, and you actually get these like short bits of comical business with the characters that are on the menu interacting in different ways. There's original gags, and anytime you select any option on the menu, there's a different thing that happens to get you out of it. Like, there's one, I think it was like season 6 or 7, where every DVD menu is the Simpsons, a different group of Simpsons characters on the couch, but anytime you select anything on the menu, you get a different couch gag. I really love that. It changes every time. Although, can I touch on something with trailers?
Yes.
They're called trailers because they used to happen after the film. They were trailing on the end. When VHSs first came out, there was a blessed brief period where the trailers were at the end of the videotape, not front-loaded before, which takes so much time. You have to fast-forward through them every time. Were you ever at that age where you thought you had to watch everything on the video?
I mean, I wouldn't sit through the whole end credits, if that's what you mean.
No, I mean, like, if you put in a videotape, you kind of thought you were obligated to watch all the trailers and the FBI warnings.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I'll do that. My mom still has some videotapes that she watches, like her favorite holiday movies. Mm-hmm. And I feel obligated to sit through some of those trailers just because it's movies I've never heard of before. It's really old stuff. It sort of makes it like a period piece almost.
Oh, hey, I got a viewer question.
From what?
From whom? It's from Michael Varhola, friend of the show, and he was asking us, have we examined the relationship between Blood Rain 3 and Blubberella?
Has he asked? Where is he asking this on?
He contacted me through Facebook.
Oh, directly. Okay. I'll talk about that connection. I know about the connection. I haven't seen either of those films, but I have seen Blood Rain 1 and 2. So, do you know what Blood Rain is, Thrasher?
Yeah, Blood Rain was originally a video game about a vampire fighting, I believe, primarily Nazis, and then it was made into a series of movies by Uwe Boll.
Uwe Boll, yeah, a German director who, he's done movies that are not video game movies, but he's done a lot of video game movies, too. And Blood Rain 3 was actually the first of the movies that sort of had something to do with the games, or is her actually fighting the Nazis. Blood Rain 1 is a prequel where it's like Lord of the Rings meets vampires, sort of that medieval setting. Blood Rain 2 was set in the Wild Wild West for whatever reason. And Blood Rain 3 was her against the Nazis like in the video game. But as they filmed it on that same set, they wanted to make use of, you know, a lot of the same actors and all this stuff. So they filmed a parody film called Blubberella, starring a really fat actress as the lead.
Is it about like an overweight superhero fighting Nazis?
Yeah, but she looked like Blood Rain, and it had a lot of the, it had most of the same actors as Blood Rain 3.
Yeah, it's almost like a Roger Corman movie.
Like, very much so, yeah.
Not the people are still awake. Let's make another movie.
Right. And, yeah, it makes me want to see both the films. I don't know. Like, I think the first Blood Rain, you look, I've seen maybe half a dozen Uwe, no, maybe closer to a dozen Uwe Boll films, but not, I mean, that guy's extremely prolific. And he's a good topic for a future sequel cast special, but, and he's done a lot of sequels, so speaking of which.
I guess we could pick one of his sagas.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, I think, like, lately his movies don't have tight scripts and he lets the actors improvise more, and I'm not sure if it's better or worse. Yeah. Because he used to heavily script the movies himself and all this stuff. So, like, I don't know. Like, his movies must be making some sort of money because he keeps on making them.
Yeah.
He did a serious film about, like, the Holocaust.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fast because there was an interview. There was actually an interview it was before Blood Rain came out. In fact, the interview may have had something to do with Blood Rain, but like where he very specifically said in the interview he had no interest in making movies about the Holocaust, and trying to make movies about the Holocaust was what was wrong with German filmmaking.
That's funny.
Although I guess maybe this is him making them as he feels they should be made.
I mean, sequel cast listeners, what do you think about like Blood Rain 3 and Blubberella? I haven't seen those myself, but you can post that at our Facebook page at facebook.com/sequelcast. So is he chatting with you on Facebook or he just sent you a private message?
Oh, no, he commented. I posted the link to this to the live feed and he commented there.
Oh, on YouTube. This makes for some awkward listening.
Technical stuff.
Technical stuff. Cool.
Oh, my.
All right. Well, I think we've talked a lot about different home video formats and bootlegs and all these things in this episode of SequelCast Special. You can check out more episodes at sequelcast.com of our other shows like SequelCast, where you look at movies in a franchise one film at a time. Sequel Commentary, where you do audio commentaries on amusing films, sometimes sequels. And we have an upcoming show that's, I think it's set to debut sometime in February, called Video Game Sequel Cast.
Yep.
Where we look at video game franchises. But that one will be a little bit different because it's not one video game per episode. It's sort of video game series on a particular system per episode.
Yeah, we would never finish. We would never get past the Marios.
But you could do an episode on the Nintendo Marios or one on the Sega CD Sonic. Well, that's not a good example. Like one on the PlayStation Final Fantasies and one on Super Nintendo Star Wars games, what have you. There's a lot of video game franchises out there for the upcoming show, Video Game Sequel Cast.
Oh my, yes.
Oh my.
Take your shirts off.
Did you see the video of George Takei reading from 50 Shades of Grey?
Yes, I've also seen the Gilbert Gottfried reading 50 Shades of Grey.
I think the Gilbert Gottfried one is funnier.
Well, like I would almost expect, like I could almost see George Takei actually being hired to do that, but like I never see Gottfried doing it.
Is there any last thing about home video formats you want to say before we close the episode for good?
No, just that after Blu-ray comes data crystals. After data crystals comes video cubes. After video cubes comes audiovisual pyramids.
I do want to say, like, the later high-definition TVs have, like, built-in 3D capabilities, but I've never... I'd be curious to test it out in a store just to see what it looks like.
Hmm. Actually, like, Sarah and I were at a store, and they had one of those TVs set up, and they were playing Avengers on it.
How did it look?
It was sort of a mixed bag, because yeah. The 3D worked, and yet... you could see every bit of artificiality in every scene, and yet those movies are inherently artificial, so it shouldn't bother me.
But it made fake stuff look even faker.
Yeah, which I know it's fake, and I actually do... Well, I guess this is the thing. It was never intended that... I love intentional artificiality, but all that stuff was never meant to look artificial. It was meant to have a certain realism to it, and this new format kind of takes that away. So it really all comes down to intent, you know. I think it really changes the director's intent.
I think also if you're doing 3D glasses at home, you have to have 3D glasses for everyone that wants to watch the TV. And the price of those glasses, you know, even though they're included with the TV, can be between like $30 to $50 per set of glasses.
And you know they probably cost about 15 cents to make.
Yeah, and some of them run off of, like, batteries, which is even worse. I can't imagine. But I will...
And the best part is going to be when 3D goes bust and then everybody's got these 3D TVs they can't do anything with.
Right. I mean, the high-definition stuff took off because that looks noticeably better, like the HDTV broadcast and stuff, whether it's streaming or through cable, but... And they're trying to work now on a format, I know we're going to close out, so we are, called 4K video, where it's like, okay. I don't know, what is it, like three times better than what Blu-ray is? I don't even know what the math on that is. And it's like, not even, I just think introducing yet another home video format just seems like a mistake and kind of greedy.
Yeah, let's this... Which actually brings up one other thing about other formats. How many damn times are we going to have to buy the same thing we already paid for?
If it's Star Wars, maybe like once every 3 years, depending on how much the different versions you want. All right, so check us out on sequelcast.com. And
also check out Chinese Ghost Story. Fantastic movie.
I've never seen it. I've heard of it.
You really need to see it.
Is it scary? Is it funny? Is it?
Yeah, it is everything. It is every kind of story.
Very good. So for the sequel cast, this is Matt.
And Thrasher.
For the sequel cast special, I should say. Saying.
Be kind, rewind.
Ah, yes. Be kind, rewind.
Be kind, rewind.
Sequelcast Special is a Hipster Goblin production.